Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. This audio will cover Leviticus 19, the last half of the chapter, verses 19 through 37. I don't really have a good title for it, so we'll call it Miscellaneous Laws. Our context is this. In the first half of chapter 19 that we covered in our last audio, verses 1 through 18, we discussed the proposition that the law is holy and that you should love your neighbor as yourself. So let's start now with Leviticus 19:19. You are to keep my statutes. You shall not breed together two kinds of your cattle. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor wear a garment upon you of two kinds of material mixed together. Now, this is one of those strange laws that are quoted a lot. It's repeated in Deuteronomy 22:9-11. You shall not sow your vineyard with two kinds of seed, or all the produce of the seed which you have sown in the increase of the vineyard will become defiled. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You shall not wear a material mixed of wool and linen together. Now, here are some options that have been given for these commands. This is my favorite. This is Adam Clark's. Quote, it was probably forbidden to prevent excitements to such unnatural lusts as those condemned in the preceding chapter, the unnatural lust referring to homosexuality and bestiality. I do not know, Mr. Clark, I do not know how refraining from wearing a shirt that has linen and cotton together is an inhibition against homosexuality or bestiality. I just don't see it. Or if I plant tomatoes and cucumbers in my garden, how that is an incitement to become a homosexual. I just don't see that. I think it's crazy. So let's look at another option. This is from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. The second option is this. Other idolatrous religions mix the things that are mentioned. Two kinds of cattle, sowing two kinds of seed in the field, wearing a garment with two kinds of material mixed together. This was done in other pagan religions, and so God wants to separate the Israelites from these pagan religions. Here's the quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, ancient Zabeans, or fire worshippers, who sowed different seeds, accompanying the act with magical rites and invocations. I've never heard of the ancient Zabeans. That's reasonable, possible. Option number three. By the way, I don't mean to dump it on Mr. Clark. He just mentions this. He's quoting the anti-homosexual option from somebody else. So it doesn't necessarily mean he believes it. Here's a third option that Clark mentions. Mingling seeds is injurious to flowers and grains. Now, I don't think that's true, but I found a quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown backing up Clark on that, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown are quoting some ancient commentator or old commentator named Whitlaw, and this is how Whitlaw's quote goes. Quote, if the various genera of the natural order Gramineae, which includes the grains and the grasses, should be sown in the same field and flower at the same time, so that the pollen of the two flowers mix. A spurious seed will be the consequence, called by the farmers chess. It is always inferior and unlike either of the two grains that produced it in size, flavor, and nutritious principles. Independently of contributing to disease, the soil, they never fail to produce the same in animals and men that feed on them. And here's an example, not from Jameson, Fawcett, Brown, but another example is that a heirloom tomato, one is not hybridized, mixed with other seeds, it tastes better and more nutritious. Well, what I got to say about that is, first of all, sure, it might be bad to mix some grains in planting, but I just talked to a missionary who does permaculture, and he's got the grains mixed together in such a way that they're complementary, the two products of those seeds are complementary and helps out in all kinds of ways is over my head. I can't believe that it is necessarily harmful to mix seeds. And even if it is, how does that explain the other two prohibitions? Mixing material of wool and linen together? That has nothing to do with planting seeds. Plowing with an ox and a donkey? Come on. That can't be the option. Option three. So let's move on to option number four. And this is what I think the answer is. The prohibition against mixing these three things was to be an object lesson against syncretism, against compromising with idolatry. Here's a quote from Tony Warren, a brother from the internet. Quote, it is the same reason God prohibited Israel from eating shellfish or pigs. Shellfish and pigs aren't immoral. Which he calls an abomination, not to illustrate that shrimp and pork were unhealthy foods, but rather the law illustrated in these ceremonial precepts the symbolism of the spiritual difference between unclean and clean people. It signified the God-breathed principle of separation. And remember what holiness is. It's separation from the world and consecration to God. So separation is holiness. So these laws against mixing things signified the God-breathed principle of separation, purity, and distinction. By God making a distinction between beasts, considered clean and could be eaten, and beasts considered unclean and not to be eaten, he was pointing to the separation of God's people from the Gentile unbelievers. The threads that could not be mixed with other diverse threads pointed to that same separation. Likewise, the donkey that could not work together with the ox and the diverse seeds that could not be planted in a field together. It was all to signify something infinitely more important than dietary, labor, and clothing restrictions. These laws regulating separation of animal seeds and threads were instituted by God as signs or parallel demonstrations to highlight the issue of keeping the children of Israel separate from the corruption of non-believers and avoid syncretism. Folks, you're not going to get a better answer than that. We go now to Leviticus 19:20-22. If a man has sexual intercourse with a woman who is a slave designated for another man, but she has not been redeemed or given her freedom, there must be punishment. They are not to be put to death because she had not been freed. However, he must bring a ram as his restitution offering, that's a guilt offering or trespass offering, to the Lord at the entrance to the tent of meeting, to the bronze altar. The priest will make atonement on his behalf before the Lord with the ram of restitution offering for the sin he has committed, and he will be forgiven for the sin he committed. All right, now this is take some looking into, because it's not immediately obvious what's going on here. So let's look at verse 20. If a man has sexual intercourse with a woman who is a slave designated for another man, NIV has promised for another man, the KJV has betrothed to another man, the New American Standard Bible has acquired by another man, Holman Christian Study Bible that I just read has designated for another man. We're to assume that she's betrothed, because that's what happens a lot of times with these slave girls. They were given in marriage to the slave owner. But she has not been redeemed or given her freedom. Now, Ellicott, the commentator, says this refers to a slave girl who has only been partially redeemed. Only partial payment has been given. The certificate of freedom has not been issued by the slave owner. I think the original Hebrew there says she has not been redeemed at all, which gives the idea of there's only been partial redemption. So she's still a slave. Money hasn't been paid yet. She's still a slave. She's not a free woman. Now, in the case of this kind of adultery, I guess, or fornication, at least sexual immorality, I guess you would even call it adultery, because if you're betrothed, engaged to a man back then, that was the same thing as being married. And then if you had sex, you would be committing adultery. However, this kind of adultery is a little bit different than the normal case. In the normal case, the parties involved in the adultery were executed, but not here. There must be punishment. Now, notice it doesn't say who's going to be punished. Is it the man or is it the woman or is it both? Well, let's look into this a little bit. The King James says she shall be scourged. Well, the King James assumes that the slave girl is at fault here and she's going to be whipped. Ellicott says this, quote, frequently the case, the effect of this visitation or requisition. Let me back up a minute. Let's talk about some of the other translations for this. There must be punishment. The Holman Christian Study Bible has. The Young's literal translation has there must be an investigation. And the Bible in Basic English says that the situation must be, quote, looked into. Well, the Cambridge commentary says that the inquisition is with a view to punishment. And that's why King James says scourged and the Holman Christian Study Bible says punished instead of just investigated. The idea is we investigate to punish. But that idea of investigation leaves open the possibility that somebody might not be punished. However, in verse 20, we read this. They are not to be put to death. They are not to be put to death. That sounds like the investigation involves punishment on both sides, the female slave and the male fornicator or seducer. They are not to be put to death. So, shows the man is to be punished also. Now, this assumes, of course, that the intercourse was consensual, that the man did not rape her. Now, if he raped her, that's a whole different story. We're assuming that he seduced her and she consented to it. Now, verse 20 says they are not to be put to death. Now, that's very interesting because, as I said earlier, the punishment for people who are not slaves, free people who are engaged and have sex, the punishment is death, but not here. This is a case where it's an advantage to be a slave. Now, We know that if a free party commits adultery, they're executed. We know that from two verses, Deuteronomy 22:22. If a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die, the man who lay with the woman and the woman. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. Leviticus 20:10, which we're going to get to in just a minute. Well, actually, in the next audio. Leviticus 20:10, if a man commits adultery with a married woman, if he commits adultery with his neighbor's wife, both the adulterer and the adulteress must be put to death. And that's pretty clear, but here they're not put to death. So here's a couple of options as why the slave girl and the seducer are not put to death. Option number one, the slave had less control over what happened. There's always the possibility the free man could have used undue influence to overpower her. Hey, baby, I want to go to bed with you. If you don't go to bed with me, I'm going to tell your master to give you some extra slave duties or something like that. You know, some kind of, she's a slave. She don't have any power. And so there could be some hanky-panky going on with the seducer to overpower her. The problem with that is if the slave girl has less power than the man, why is the man not punished more severely since he would be more at fault? Well, we can assume that both the man and the woman would be scourged and whipped. The Hebrew here says, according to the commentator Benson, there shall be a scourging. It says there shall be punishment. He says there shall be a scourging, which probably may belong to both of them. For first, both were guilty. Second, it follows they shall not be punished with death, which may seem to imply that they were to be punished by some other common and considerable punishment, which scourging indeed was. But the paying of a ram was a small penalty. That's for the guilt offering, very unsuitable to the greatness of the offense. Well, we'll leave out the guilt offering for just a minute and just say that if both of the parties are scourged, they're both punished for what happens, that answers the question of why the man is not punished. He was punished, but he's not punished more severely than the woman, and he's let off. He's not executed. So this option number one, the slave had less control over what happened, the Adam Clark solution, that doesn't answer the question for why is the man not punished. Why is he punished less than death? Because he did have the power to unduly influence the situation. So I don't think that's a good option. And I wasn't able to find in the commentaries any other reason, but this is an idea I had. If this slave girl was executed, the slave owner would get screwed out of his property by the sins of another man. He would lose his female slave. And his female slave could have been seduced by a man using undue influence on her. So she is less culpable. I don't know how that will stand up in the court of theological opinion, but that's the best I can do on that. Now, there must be punishment. We assume punishment for both. And I'm assuming both parties are guilty. If they investigate this and it turns out that it was a rape, well, then the woman's not going to be punished. Now, I can't imagine how the slave girl would be at fault and the man not be at fault. So there would only be punishment of the slave girl and not the man. But I can see how there would be a situation where the man would be at fault and the slave girl not really, because she was seduced. So you might let the slave girl off. But assuming it was consensual intercourse, without going into all the niceties and probabilities and permutations, they both of them going to get punished, but not killed, not executed. Now, after all that punishment is done, the man has to make a guilt offering. King James has a trespass offering. The Hillman Christian Study Bible has a restitution offering. Unfortunately, that fourth kind of bloody sacrifice doesn't have a common name. I'm going to call it a guilt offering because that's what most of the modern translations use. Now, guilt offering was always a ram, a male lamb, and if possible, the offender paid 20% restitution to the person he offended. So if, for example, if somebody stole, if party A stole a $1,000 bull from party B, then party A would have to pay, and the bull dies, then party A would have to pay B $1,200, 20%. But that 20% restitution is only in cases where it's possible to be paid. In this case, how do you judge the damage that's being done to the slave owner? My slave girl just had sex. Pay me 20% of what? So there is no 20% given here. It's impossible to calculate the damages. Now, one more point that I made in a previous audio, it's a myth out there that guilt offerings are done only for unintentional sins. Well, folks, that is so easy to disprove, it's not even funny. Here we have a man seducing a slave. That's unintentional. Oh, gee, Your Honor, I just kind of walked by and she looked kind of nice. And the next thing I know, I was having sex with her, but I didn't really mean to do it. So here's my sin offering. Come on. That's an intentional sin. By the way, I can find four other places where guilt offerings covered intentional sin. Leviticus 5:1, you got somebody that's subpoenaed before the court. He doesn't respond to this public call to testify. Afterwards, he gives a sin offering. That's another option. How about Leviticus 6? Here we have somebody who deceives his neighbor in regard to a deposit, a security, or he even robs or defrauds his neighbor in somehow. Listen, if you steal somebody's deposit, if you rob somebody, if you defraud your neighbor, folks, that is not unintentional. That's intentional. And then there's the 20%, the fifth of the value that has to be added. There's the restitution offering right there in Leviticus 6. So that's two options. And then, there are two examples of guilt offerings given for intentional sin. And then this one that we just talked about, having sex with a slave girl, that's a third example. Here's a fourth example. Ezra 10:18-19, the following were found to have married foreign women from the descendants of the priest. They pledged to send their wives away, and being guilty, they offered a ram from the flock for their guilt. Oh, I married a foreigner. I married an idolater. I married a pagan woman. It just happened. I don't know why it happened. It was unintentional. I didn't mean it, Your Honor. Come on. Here's the fifth example. The Lord spoke to Moses, tell the Israelites when a man or a woman commits any sin against another. And then he has to do a trespass offering. Any sin, that would include intentional as well as unintentional sins. I don't know what it is about myths in the body of Christ, but I've seen a lot of people say this thing about unintentional sins. Only unintentional sins were covered by the Levitical sacrifices. Well, if you look at the trespass offering, it included intentional sins. I don't know about the other ones, but this one is intentional sins. The pulpit commentary says, quote, no mention is made of damages to be paid to the man to whom the slave girl was betrothed. That's assuming the slave girl was engaged or betrothed to the owner of the slave girl. But he doesn't get any damages, probably because he was himself a slave and had no juridical rights against a freeman. Well, that's interesting. That's the pulpit commentary came up with that idea. That might be looking too deep into the situation, assuming too much, because it doesn't matter who that slave girl was betrothed to a master or to another slave. He was defrauded, but you can't calculate the damages. And the public commentator backs me up on that. He says, they say it's impossible to estimate the damage of the wrong, regardless of who the girl was engaged to. Now, in verse 21, one other problem, only the man brought the trespass offering. The slave girl did not have to. John Gill says the reason for this is that a slave girl would not have the financial means to present a trespass offering. Could be. Leviticus 19, verses 23 through 25. When you enter the land and plant all kinds of trees for food, then you shall count their fruit as forbidden. 3 years it shall be forbidden to you. It shall not be eaten. But in the fourth year, all its fruit shall be holy, an offering of praise to the Lord. In the fifth year, you are to eat of its fruit, that its yield may increase for you. I am the Lord your God. Now, verse 23 says, when you enter the land, that's talking about the land of Canaan. Remember, they're still at Mount Sinai now receiving these laws. So in the future, you're not going to plant fruit trees in the desert, of course, but when you get into the promised land running with milk and honey, you're to plant fruit trees, but you don't eat for 3 years. Now, why is that? Well, first of all, when you don't eat, it doesn't mean that you don't pick off the fruit. Now, that's a good question. Does it mean that you pick off the fruit, but you don't eat in order to prune the tree and make it grow better? I'm not a farmer, so I don't know. Or does it mean that you just leave the fruit on there and let it fall off naturally? I don't know. But here are a couple reasons as to why you don't eat the fruit for 3 years. First, this is mentioned by John Gill and Adam Clark. First reason is that the tree grows stronger and grows stronger fruit the next year for those 3 years. Gives the tree a chance to get started. I think that makes sense. John Gill suggests or mentions a second option is that if you eat fruit for the first 3 years, that fruit is not healthy to humans. I don't believe that. So this is just to allow the fruit tree a chance to get established and to get strong. Now, the interesting thing is the fourth year, the fruit's not to be eaten. An offering of praise to the Lord, it says. Now, that means that the tree sort of offers its own fruit as a first fruits offering to God. It doesn't say that you pick the fruit and then take it to the temple as a first fruits offering. But I wonder if that could not be the case. I really do believe it was the case. Matthew Poole agrees with me. He says, quote, he says that the fruit was, quote, consecrated to the Lord as the first fruits in tithes were, and therefore given to the priest and Levites. Now in verse 25, it says, in the fifth year, you're to eat its fruit. So you had to wait 4 years, and in the fifth year you could start eating the fruit of the tree, and of course that implies all the years thereafter, as long as the tree continues to live, you can eat the fruit. We go now to Leviticus 19, verse 26. You shall not eat anything with the blood, nor practice divination or soothsaying. This is a repetition of other scriptures. Well, both before and after the scripture, we have prohibitions against eating flesh with the blood. Genesis 9:4 says, only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. That was before the law. Then after the law, during the times of the Babylonian exile, Ezekiel 33:25-26. Therefore say to them, thus says the Lord God, you eat meat with the blood in it. Lift up your eyes to your idols as you shed blood. In other words, you're doing two bad things, idolatry and eating meat with blood in it. And then in verse 26, Ezekiel says, you rely on your sword, you commit abominations, and each of you defiles his neighbor's wife. Should you then possess the land? So eating meat with blood in it is likened unto using your sword immorally, committing abominations, that's idolatrous abomination, and then defiling your neighbor's wife, that means shacking up with your neighbor's wife. All of that is put in a series of sins that includes eating meat with the blood in it. So you see, it's serious business. Now, why? What's the point of not eating meat with blood in it? This makes the Israelites esteem blood very highly. It makes blood very valuable. Why? Because blood is what atones for sins in the sacrificial system. Life is in the blood. Leviticus 17:11. Life is in the blood. And so therefore, we're only going to use this blood to take care of our sins. Because blood stands for life. Life has to be given for the lives that have been taken by sinners, assuming that sinners have committed the worst crimes that they can, and that includes capital crimes, murdering people. So life has got to be given for life. So blood is very, very important. So you don't eat anything with the blood in it, because you're profaning it by doing that. Now, there's another possible reason why you don't eat meat with blood in it. Jameson Fawcett Brown mentions this, because eating blood was a prominent part of pagan idolatrous rituals. Here's their quote. But the practice against which the law here pointed was an idolatrous rite. The Zabians, or worshippers of the heavenly host, were accustomed in sacrificing animals to pour out the blood and eat a part of the flesh at the place where the blood was poured out. And sometimes the blood itself they would eat, believing that means of it, friendship, brotherhood, and familiarity were contracted between the worshippers and the deities. They moreover supposed that the blood was very beneficial in obtaining for them a vision of the demon during their sleep and a revelation of future events. The prohibition against eating blood, viewed in the light of this historic commentary and unconnected with the peculiar terms in which it is expressed, seems to have been leveled against idolatrous practices, as is further evident from Ezekiel 33:25... That's the verse I just read to you from Ezekiel. So Jameson Fawcett Brown connects eating blood up with idolatrous rites, and it could be both. It could be to protect the sanctity of the Levitical rituals and also to guard against pagan idolatrous practices. But for whatever reason, Israelites were not to eat blood. I guess I wonder if you were eating a steak, you see the steak, you see all that gravy, and there's a little bit of red in there. That means that's blood, and you can't eat that. Oh, my gosh. But we're not under the law, folks, so I'm going to eat my steak. You're not to practice divination and soothsaying. The law continues here in verse 26. Now, divination and soothsaying is still with us. It's everywhere. I used to wonder, what in the world is that when I used to be a rationalist? I'm not a rationalist anymore. I know there are demons out there, and they're everywhere. I know in China, even non-Christians aren't rationalists. They know about demons. I remember, what was that guy's name? He was the former boyfriend of a young lady who's now almost like my daughter, who I led to the Lord. And this boyfriend, we were talking about Ouija boards because they were doing Ouija boards. And I was talking about how demons were bad, you know, and evil. And this boy, who, to as far as I know, has never become a Christian, he starts saying, oh, this is terrible. This is terrible. He was scared of demons because his grandmother, a Buddhist, was possessed in some kind of a demonic trance and started acting crazy in a Buddhist temple one time. And so he didn't have any trouble with me talking about demons, and he was not a Christian. But anybody that's been around long enough I've seen demons. I've seen the people who've been possessed by demons. And when you read enough occult literature, and I've read a little bit of it, I remember reading a book by John Warden Montgomery on the occult, and I said, that's it. That's all I want to know. It's an excellent book. He basically describes what spirit worshipers, mediums, spirit manipulators do. They communicate with demons and do little tricks to suck people in. In China, these spiritists are called Xuanming Xianchengs. Xuanming means calculate. Xuan means calculate. Ming means life. Calculate your life, misters. Xianchung is mister. Calculate your life, mister. In other words, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen, because that's what all spiritists do. They try to alleviate people's worries about the future. Of course, everybody worries about the future. We're supposed to put our future in God's hands so we don't worry about it anymore. That's the goal. That's what Jesus offers his Christians through the Holy Spirit. Well, the demons do their counterfeiting work to try to alleviate people's fear of the future. That's why you see these signs with the red hand, you know, come, I'll tell your fortune, tarot cards, I'll tell your future, I'll read the lines in your hands, and all this stuff. And they do the same type of stuff. Now, that stuff's been around for generations, and it was always forbidden. Leviticus 19:31, which we'll get to in just a minute, do not turn to mediums or spiritists. Do not seek them out to be defiled by them. Exodus 22:18, you shall not allow a sorceress to live. Deuteronomy 18:14, for those nations which you shall dispossess, listen to those who practice witchcraft and to diviners. But you're not allowed to do so. 1 Samuel 28:9, but the woman said to him, behold, you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off those who are mediums and spiritists from the land. So Saul cut off mediums and spiritists, killed them. Isaiah 47:12 through 14, stand fast now in your spells and in your many sorceries with which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps you may cause trembling. You are worried with your many counsels. Let now the astrologers, those who prophesy by the stars, those who predict by the new moons, stand up and save you from what will come upon you. Behold, they have become like stubble. Fire burns them. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame. There will be no coal to warm by, nor a fire to sit before. Bad, bad, bad results for people who follow astrologers. I remember I was trying to talk a young Chinese professor at one of my colleges in China that I was teaching in, and she was talking about the signs of the zodiac, and she was basically talking about New Age stuff she'd gotten off the internet. I said, oh, what a great influence the West has on China. And I gave her a book about Jesus, and I tried to witness to her, and she wanted to follow those spirits. So I kind of gave up on it, and about 2 years, I don't know, maybe 3-4 years, long time afterwards, I'd gone to another college and actually gone back to America. And I contacted her again, and she'd gotten married, and she'd given up the demons. But she still wasn't a believer. So I thought that was one step in the right direction anyway. But anyway, enough talk about demons. Let's go to Leviticus 19, verse 27 and 28. You are not to cut off the hair at the sides of your head or mar the edge of your beard. You are not to make gashes on your bodies for the dead or put tattoo marks on yourselves. I am Yahweh. Now cut off the hair, the NIV has cut the hair at the sides of your head. Holman Christian Study Bible has cut off the hair at the sides of your head. Now, of course, what does sides of your head mean? Does that mean all the way up to the top? Does it mean to the top of the ear? Does it mean front of the ear, behind the ear? I don't know. I'm just going to say bald. Bald. Mar the edge of your beard. Again, that's the same thing. You cut off the edge of your beard. That means cut your beard. The hair on the sides of your head, as John Gill said, could be on the forehead, could be on the temples, could be behind the ears. Who knows? John Gill says that doing all this made Egyptian hair look like if it was in a bowl. Well, I used to worry about what the hair looked like. I'm going to assume it's bald, like a cue ball, or at least bald all the way up to the sides and in the front. It doesn't matter what it looked like. The point is what is the reason for this? Well, the reason was, as John Gill says, is that idolaters did this. They shaved their heads like this, or the priest did it. And I assume back then when they shaved their head, they used flintstone, got it sharp, real. They didn't have razor blades in it. They didn't have steel, so they used flintstones. Jameson Fawcett Brown said this shaving of the head was an age-old practice, as was the cutting of the flesh mentioned in the same verse. Here's some examples in the scripture in Isaiah 15:2. They have gone up to the temple and to Dibon, even to the high places to weep. Moab wails over Nebo and Medema. Everyone's head is bald and every beard is cut off. Now, that could be for mourning because they're upset because they got whipped. But it could be because they're idolaters. Jeremiah 16:6, both great men and small will die in this land. They will not be buried. They will not be lamented. Nor will anyone gash himself or shave his head for them. Now, there you have gashing and shaving right in the same breath. So that sounds like that's what idolaters do. Of course, that could be mourning, too. Gashing yourself or shaving your head because of mourning as opposed to just ordinary idolatry. But I think here it's idolatry. Now, the cutting of the flesh, which is prohibited in this verse 28, was often associated with pagan mourning and idolatry. Kind of runs together. Here's a quote from John Gill. Either with their nails tearing their cheeks and other parts, or with any instrument, knife, razor, etc. Jarchi says, it was the custom of the Amorites when anyone died to cut their flesh, as it was of the Scythians, as Herodotus relates, even those of the royal family. For a king, they cut off a part of the ear, shaved the hair round about, cut the arms about, wounded the forehead and nose, and transfixed the left hand with arrows. And so the Carthaginians, who might receive it from the Phoenicians, being a colony of theirs, used to tear their hair and mouths in mourning and beat their breast. And with the Romans, the women used to tear their cheeks in such a manner that it was forbid by the law of the 12 tables, which some had thought was taken from hence. And all this was done to appease the infernal deities and to give them satisfaction for the deceased and to make them propitious to them. In other words, let's make the demons happy and slash and cut and tear our flesh. The Israelites couldn't do that. Here's a quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. This cutting is, quote, the practice of making deep gashes on the face and arms and legs in time of bereavement was universal among the heathen, and it was deemed a becoming mark of respect for the dead, as well as a sort of propitiatory offering to the deities who presided over death and the grave. So, it was slashing for mourning, but it was also slashing to appease demons. And obviously, God doesn't want them to do that. Now, also in this verse, he says, no tattoos. Tattoos were usually done as an idolatrous practice. The name of the pagan god was imprinted upon the idolaters to show that the idolater belonged to the demon god. In other words, you might have Dagon tattooed on your skin. Now, this comes up, I don't know how many times, I guess because it's a big fad now in the world. People are tattooing themselves all over the place. I just had an Indian woman who my wife and I have been keeping up with since she got saved about 9 or 10 years ago in China. And her daughter has decided she wants a tattoo. And does the Bible say anything against it? Well, of course you think about this first, but this is under the Old Testament law, and its purpose was had to do with idolatry. It is possible to get tattooed without committing idolatry. So this verse does not apply to the current fad of tattooing one's skin and making it look ugly as Gehenna. And so that was the tack I took. He said, why would you want to do that? I read somewhere that a tattoo for an NBA ball player cost him X number of millions of dollars in endorsements. It just makes you look like a hood. And they're ugly. They're not pretty. They don't adorn a woman's skin, for example. They're just ugly as sin. Why would you want to put that on there? Also, oh, let's say your girlfriend now is Rose, so you put a heart with Rose on. Oh, I'm going to love you forever. Well, all of a sudden you break up with Rose, and now you're in love with Mary. What you going to do about that tattoo? Pay $3,000 and get it taken off? That's easier said than done. Getting a tattoo is stupid, but it's not unscriptural. In my humble opinion, of course. This idea of writing on the skin to show that you belong to a god, it's also true about Christians having writing on their hand. This is symbolically speaking, showing that they belong to Yahweh. Isaiah 44:5, or believers belonging to Yahweh. Isaiah 44:5, this one will say, I am the Lord, and that one will call on the name of Jacob, and another will write on his hand, belonging to the Lord. Revelation 13:7, and he provides that no one will be able to buy or sell. This is the beast. No one will be able to buy or sell the Roman Empire, the sea beast. No one will be able to buy or to sell except the one who has the mark of the beast, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. And what did that mark show? It showed that the person who had the mark belonged to the sea beast, belonged to the Roman Empire. It shows belonging, possession. And of course, that is not necessarily a physical mark, but it's because it was in a vision. In John's vision, but the idea is that it shows possession. We look at Revelation 14:1. Then I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000. Those were the symbolic of the Jewish saints who were preserved when they escaped to Pella in AD 70 during the Jewish war with the Roman Empire. And also later, they stood for the whole rest of the saints that came along afterwards. And all of these saints, all of these 144,000 saints had his name, God's name, and the name of, Jesus' name, the Lamb's name, had Jesus' name and the name of his Father, Yahweh, had the name of the Son and the Father written on their foreheads, again, to show ownership. So when you get tattooed with a tattoo with the name of Dagon or some idol Baal or Astarte or something, that means I belong to you. And of course, that is not going to be allowed to the Israelites. We go now to Leviticus 19, verses 29 through 31. Do not profane your daughter by making her a harlot, so that the land will not fall to harlotry and the land become full of lewdness. You shall keep my Sabbaths and revere my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Do not turn to mediums or spiritists. Do not seek them out to be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God. Now, when it says, don't profane your daughter by making her a harlot, you would wonder, why would anybody want to make their daughter a prostitute? Well, it probably is probably referring to temple prostitution. That might be considered an honor in a pagan religion. And so he said, okay, yes, honey, why don't you be a temple prostitute so you can help people get close to the demon god. Verse 30 says, you shall keep my Sabbaths and revere my sanctuary. The revering the sanctuary, keeping it holy, is probably referring back to the previous verse. How do you revere God's sanctuary? You keep temple prostitutes out of it. And of course, keeping the Sabbath. Of course, the Sabbath is a sign of the Mosaic covenant. So you keep the Sabbath. That shows that you still belong to God. That's easy enough. Now, verse 31 says, do not turn to mediums or spiritists. Spiritists is a good translation there, but the KJV has, do not turn to them that have familiar spirits. And I've always thought that was funny. What is a familiar spirit? Well, this is my idea, a demon who was familiar with the medium. And then that demon would help the medium with his or her putative communications with the dead. Now, Adam Clark wants to give a naturalistic sort of explanation to this. I don't believe that in a minute. I mean, there can be naturalistic explanations. They're fake mediums. I mean, Houdini went around trying to expose fake mediums. I'm sure they're fake mediums. I know they're fake mediums, but I also know they're real ones, too. Now, here's what Clark says about this word spiritist. Quote, the Hebrew word oboth probably signifies a kind of engastromuthoi, or ventriloquist. I don't know what in the world engastromuthoi is, but ventriloquist I do know. So see, that's a ventriloquist is a natural thing. And so he's saying, don't turn to people who use ventriloquism to convince you that a voice is coming from your deceased loved one. Gives a naturalistic explanation to this. And I don't think that's proper. That's not the main focus. Clark also goes on to say that it could be the Pythoness mentioned. This is the famous Pythoness, the oracle of the at Delphi, the temple at Delphi in Greece. These oracles, they were called Pythoness because there was supposed to be some kind of snake under there, if I remember correctly. I forgot why. But anyway, they were priestesses of this pagan temple, and they would get under the influence of their demon. They became greatly inflated and gave answers in a sort of frenzy. Well, some people say that gas came out of the crack there. I've been there. You can walk up there and see the flat rock where they prophesied from, and the gas was supposed to come out of the crack in the rock and get them overcome, and they would give their prophecies. Well, fine. There might be naturalistic explanations, but basically it's demons talking to the spiritists. That's the best way. If you don't believe in demons, just study the occult, and you will see that demons do things that naturalists cannot explain, but they can't do as much as God can do. They do that to impress people with their power. You know, I despise the New Age movement because it's demonic, but I imagine that if a skeptic, a naturalist, looked at all the New Age stuff, they would realize that the New Age people hold them in utter contempt because they know that a lot of supernatural stuff goes on. What they're deceived about is that supernatural stuff is bad, bad, bad business. I mean, you want to get sleep paralysis where you lie in the bed and you can't wake up. You want to be lying in the bed if you're a girl and all of a sudden some demon comes in there and rapes you while you're in your sleep and you can't wake up. It's the kind of stuff that goes on in the New Age. They're demons, folks. That's not naturalistic. We go now to Leviticus 19, verses 32 through 34. You shall rise up before the gray-headed and honor the aged, and you shall revere your God. I am the Lord. When a stranger resides with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. For you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Now rise up before the gray-headed. That's just to show honor. Oh, I love that verse. Because I'm gray-headed, and I love respect like any other old person would. And that's what I loved about China. Boy, they honored the old folks in China. They're famous for it, and for good reason. I lived there for 23 years, and I can tell you it's true. I got so much honor over there, it was almost embarrassing. honored as an old person and also as a foreigner. I remember one time I was in a taxi in Yichuan, in the west of or midwest of China, and I told a taxi driver I was 49 years old. Maybe it was 59 years old. I can't remember. I think it might have been 49. And he started saying, well, that's such a shame. I'm so sorry. And I said, what's wrong with being 49 years old? Well, let's say it was 59 years old. I think it was 59 years old. What's wrong with that? He says, because one more year and you'll be 60. Well, I found out later in Chinese culture, 60 is a whopping good thing. It means, by golly, you are old and you deserve honor. And I wasn't there yet. I hadn't arrived yet. It's great what Eastern cultures do with the old. Contrast that with American culture, where some smarty pants millennial says, hey, boomer, just to disrespect somebody who's older than they are. I remember there was an NFL game at the end where before the clock had run out, I might have the details fuzzy, but the quarterback ran over and got his picture taken by somebody in the stands on the cell phone. He was prancing around a little bit. And an elderly quarterback in the NFL, retired quarterback, said that this young quarterback had not shown respect to the other team and to the sport by doing that. And so this was the response on Twitter as someone was objecting to the Joe Theismann's comments. He just said, hey, boomer. In other words, I'm not going to even talk to you and argue with you about was this action showing respect or not. I'm going to dismiss you without even arguing just by appealing to the fact that you're an old guy. And that attitude is everywhere in the United States of America, and it stinks. The Israelites were not supposed to be like Americans. They were supposed to honor the aged, and they're supposed to revere their God. Notice that reverencing God here is closely connected with honoring the aged. You know, my mother's in an assisted living home, and I am amazed that these Christians that go out to this home, they don't get any honor for it, they don't get any credit for it, and they look after these old people. And you'll find a lot of Christians like that. They just love old people. They go out there and they play bingo with them and read Bible stories to them, play the piano for them, give them concerts and all this stuff. Honor the aged. Verse 33 says, when a stranger resides with you, that's an alien, a sojourner, somebody that's not a native Israelite, when he resides, you don't do him wrong. Verse 34, he's to be treated just like a native Jew. No difference. Now note how these two verses give honor and protection to the weak. The elderly are supposed to be honored in verse 32, and because old people are weak, verse 33, a stranger is weak too. He doesn't have the same civil protections and cultural protections that a native person does. Now, I love that verse because I was an alien in China for 23 years. And it's true. You just do not feel as comfortable in a foreign country as a sojourner, as a stranger, as an alien, as you do in your native country. Especially when that country is run by a bunch of frippin' communists. You don't carry your passport with you. Oh, my gosh, what if this cop stops me and I don't have my passport? Oh, my gosh, what's going to happen? They could send me out of here on 48 hours notice if they decided I'm preaching the gospel too much. You just don't have as much protection when you're an alien. Here's what Adam Clark says about being a stranger, an alien. Quote, none is so desolate as the stranger, and none needs the offices of benevolence and charity more. And we may add that he who is not afflicted by the desolate state of the stranger has neither benevolence nor charity. Oh, I like that. The desolate state of the stranger. That was me. That was me in China. Desolate. I didn't have any. I remember one time, I think in 23 years, I lost my temper one time. And I remember, I didn't actually yell at anybody, but I, in America, we would say stood up for my rights. I remember I was about to get booted out of a university job because of my Christian group that was meeting there every Sunday morning, and it was well known on campus, and the communist in the local city found out about it, put pressure on the university and said, get rid of this guy. And so they were trying to do petty little things to harass me to make me leave on my own. I said, what I suspect. And this communist guy, his job was, he was the communist overseer of the university department there, the business department. They have to have communists looking after things to make sure that everybody's ideologically pure. And he starts giving me all kinds of grief about how I was doing my class and my exams. And it was stupid, absolutely stupid. And he got my back up. And I remember saying to him, you're violating my academic freedom. And then I thought as I said that, wait a minute, I'm in China. I don't have any academic freedom. I am totally at their mercy, which I was, and they fired me. So being an alien is not pleasant. The Israelites have to look at the aliens just like themselves. Adam Clark says it was politically and spiritually smart to be kind to aliens. Why? Because they helped build a strong nation of Israel. They had opportunity to know the one true God, as Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown say. Two reasons. Strong nations, and you bring them in, they have a chance to learn about Yahweh. You know, it's interesting, in Israel now, they have an Arab minority, Israeli Arabs, I think they call them. They have their own parliamentary party. In fact, they just entered into a coalition to get rid of Netanyahu, the Islamist Arabs, joined in with the far-right wing Orthodox Jews who want to reestablish a Jewish Old Testament kingdom in Israel. Talk about strange bedfellows and politics making strange bedfellows. Well, they're in a coalition. I don't know how long it'll last, probably about 3 days, but they're in that coalition. But all of these Arabs that come into Israel, if Israel was following God the way they were supposed to be doing by worshiping the Messiah, Jesus Christ, well, all those Arabs would have a chance to know Jesus. And we could also think about all the aliens that are coming into America right now, many of them illegally, along with the drug dealers and the sex traffickers and all that stuff that are coming in. But they also got other people coming in that might hear the gospel. Might as well look at the bright side. So anyway, being kind to aliens, it's a moral thing. You're supposed to do that. Now, that doesn't mean you say, oh, just open the border like these morons that are running our government now are doing, and just opening the border to anybody. If you don't have a border, you don't have a nation. Right now, we don't have a border on the south, and I think that's stupid. But having said that, once the alien gets here, whether legally or illegally, you need to be kind to them. That would be a good application from this verse. Hebrews 13:2. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. And I think that the author of Hebrews was referring to when Abraham entertained those two angels plus Jesus, the manifestation of Jesus, the epiphany of Jesus, in Genesis down there when right before those angels went on down to Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham showed great hospitality. If you remember the story, he got Sarah to run in there and fix some food real quick. Ah, come on in here and eat. He didn't know there were angels. So be kind to a stranger. Be kind to an alien. You never know what good thing might come of it. Let's go now to Leviticus 19:35, verse 35 through 37 to finish up this chapter. You shall do no wrong in judgment, in measurement of weight or capacity. You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah. Homo Christian Study Bible translates ephah as a dry measure. You shall have just weights, a just dry measure, and a just hin. Homo Christian Study Bible translates that as a liquid measure. So you need to have a just weight. A just balance would mean like if you've seen these balances. The Chinese used to use these back in the 1990s. You'd hold the balance up, and then if you want to buy 2 gene of jutes of mandarin oranges, you'd put the mandarin oranges on one side, and then you would put a lead weight on the other so you could weigh how much mandarin oranges you're getting. Well, if that person wanted to cheat me, he just put a light weight on the other side of the balance, and then it reads 2 gene of mandarin oranges, but it's only 1.5 gene, that kind of thing. So that's a balance. And likewise, if you're paying somebody in silver or gold as far as weight, not a coin, but weight, well, then you would have a heavy weight on your side of the balance, so that when it looks like 1 ounce of gold I'm giving you, when I ask for 1 ounce, the weight reads 1 ounce, but it actually is 2 ounces. And so I have to put 2 ounces of gold to register 1 ounce. And so I have to pay more than I'm supposed to. So there's your typical crooked balance and just weights that go on the balances. And the ephah is a measure, and a hin is a liquid measure. And if you make the measure the wrong size, I'm going to give you 1 ephah of grain, but the ephah is too small, then I cheat you. I don't give you enough grain. Same thing with a hin. I'm going to give you a hin of wine, but hey, my measure is too small, so I cheat you. I give you less wine than you deserve. All right, so God says none of that. I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt. You shall thus observe all my statutes and all my ordinances and do them. I am the Lord. Now this verse 35, you shall do no wrong in judgment. That's a repeat from Leviticus 19:15 earlier in the chapter. That verse says this, quote, you must not act unjustly when deciding a case. Do not be partial to the poor or give preference to the rich. Judge your neighbor fairly. So that's interesting. When it says do not do wrong in judgment, that means don't cheat the rich person any more than you cheat the poor person. Unusual to throw that in there about not cheating a poor, not cheating a rich person. Usually you don't think about them as the ones getting cheated. Justice, not economic status. Good application of that is justice, not the color of your skin, as unfortunately America is entering into a neo-segregationist policy of critical race theory where people are judged by the color of their skin. No, it's by whether the person is right or wrong, guilty or innocent. That's the measure. That's the standard. Now, there were no standard weights and measures in ancient society at that time. That meant that cheating in business standards was very common, and we can see this because it's everywhere in the scriptures. Let me show you this. Deuteronomy 25:13-16. You shall not have in your bag differing weights, a large and a small. You shall not have in your house differing measures, a large and a small. You shall have a full and just weight. Large and a small means large if you're measuring out how much gold you owe me, and small if I'm measuring out how much product I owe you. You shall have a full and just weight. You shall have a full and just measure, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. For everyone who does these things, everyone who acts unjustly, is an abomination to the Lord your God. Proverbs 11:1. A false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. Proverbs 16:11. A just balance and scales belong to the Lord. All the weights of the bag are his concern. He's worried about these fake measures that you're doing. You know, talk about standards of weights and lengths and measurements. There's an office in Washington, D.C. where there are these platinum bars, I think they are, that are measured down to the 5 jillionth of a millimeter to make sure it's the right standard, and the scientific means to which people go to have accurate standards. It's amazing. And by the way, the same thing goes for currencies. How many times through history have kings or governments debase their currency, thus creating inflation? It happens all the time. It happened all the way through the Byzantine Empire. It happened all the way through the English history. And then some new king had to come back and remint all the coins and make them have a standard weight so people would trust the coinage again. It's the same idea. You don't cheat people by clipping your coins or inflating your or debasing your coinage or inflating your currency, United States of America, as we face horrible inflation. I'm speaking now in June of 2021. Years later, if you're listening to this, you can see how it all turned out. Proverbs 20:10, differing weights and differing measures, both of them are abominable to the Lord. Proverbs 20:23, differing weights are an abomination to the Lord, and a false scale is not good. Amos 8:5, when will the new moon be over so that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath that we may open the wheat market, to make the bushel smaller and the shekel bigger, and to cheat with dishonest scales? That's Amos complaining about his contemporaries. Micah 6:10-11. Is there yet a man in the wicked house along with treasures of wickedness and a short measure that is cursed? Can I justify wicked scales and a bag of deceptive weights? So you see, this is everywhere back then. This is the way people cheated people, with unjust measures. The chapter is finished off in verse 37. You shall thus observe all my statutes. That's not just talking about the honest weights and measures, but it's not just talking about the statutes that we just looked at in chapter 19. It's talking about all of the statutes in the preceding chapters as well, of course. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished with Leviticus chapter 19, verses 19 through 37. I went through several miscellaneous laws. Now we are ready for Leviticus 20. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 27. We'll look, amongst other things, at child sacrifice and sexual immorality. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.